Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Profoundly Pointless. My name is Nick Van Zandt. Coming up in this episode, ice sculptures and winter animals.
In a way, I think there's a ghost that you always carry, you know, when you're creating something static. Whereas in ice, it's gone. And there's something very liberating about it. How warm ice and cold ice interact is very different. And these little sciences that we know, we manipulate to the max to create what we create. And then I use a chainsaw, no matter how big, how small the sculpture is, I would say about 70% of the work we do, we use a chainsaw.
I want to thank you so much for joining us. If you get a chance, subscribe, leave us a rating or a review. We really appreciate it. It really helps us out. If you're a new listener, welcome to the show. If you're a longtime listener, thank you so much for all of your support. So our first guest creates some of the biggest, most intricate, and awe-inspiring ice sculptures in the world. This is world champion ice sculptor Shintaro Akamoto. What is it about ice? Like, why ice?
To me, ice is the most under-investigated, underappreciated material. You know, ice is ephemeral. It's constantly changing, deteriorating, disappearing material. I see ice as more of a performance piece. All the work that goes in there to create something, but I think the real power happens once he leaves our studio. Ice has a volume, but no color, with the transparency. So, it relies on its silhouette and contour. It's crystalline in the sense that it really resolves its volume through light. So we have to think about, refractions. Ice has, a real fitting place in places like events industry, because it's that one time, of the moment, kind of physicalizing the time passing kind of thing,
That makes sense to me in the sense that art, that ice as art is always changing. Is that something that kind of drew you to it in that regard, that this sculpture that I created at 8 o'clock is not going to be the same as the sculpture is at 9 o'clock?
I mean, that constant changing is definitely attractive. No matter how much we kind of have idea, a plan of what it will do, it's always defies the expectations, because there are so many variables to what will change ice, from the room temperature to airflow to sunlight, or how much people are touching, interacting, and to me it's just humbling, because my formal training as a painter, something that's incredibly on the up, static on the other end of it. And once you create something, it stays and lives with you. And on a personal level, I see what I learn from, but I'm always running to move on to kind of, grow from that point. It's when you're making something, I think, that stays, you're thinking about what next can you create. And in a way, I think there's a ghost that you always carry, when you're creating something static. Whereas in ice, it's gone. And there's something very liberating about it. And it has allowed me to just really focus and enjoy the process.
Is ice, from a technical standpoint, is it fundamentally harder or easier to work with than other sculpting mediums?
As a sculpting process, it's very similar to any other hard material carving. It's essentially reductive carving. The tools that we use, from chainsaws, chisels, drills, saws, it's about, taking away the negative material, and you know, creating a form that lives within a space. So if you have a very sharp material, you know, it's a very similar process. The big difference with, I think, any other material is that you can execute incredibly fast. So what it takes for in days and weeks, months with stone or wood, we can realize it in hours. I think that's something very, very different.
Why is that? Is that just because ice is a more malleable material, or because of the techniques that you're using? Like, why are you able to do it faster?
I think with a sharp tools, it's very receptive to cutting, you know? I mean, I think that's the interesting about ice as a material, is there's this constant kind of polar dichotomy to it, that it's, but it's, cause it's hard, but it's soft. It's strong, but it's fragile. And, you know, depending on how ice gets hit on the surface at what angle, it reacts very differently. You know, it's heavy, but it's buoyant. You know, it floats in water. You know, it's a very interesting material.
Yeah, I would imagine like you could crack it all the way through quite easily.
You can, but I mean, if you have an ice pick that has a force in one singular, you know, point, it can shatter. But if you take a sledgehammer and try to break ice, it actually doesn't break that easily. You know, so how you hit and where you hit, ice behaves very differently.
Could you step into another medium? Could you go work with wood or go work with stone? Like, could you translate to another medium easier than somebody could come into ice, do you think?
The act of carving is very similar. The tools we use to carve is very similar. But like with any material, it has its own tendencies that we all have to learn. So does it cross over well? Yeah, I think it does cross over well. And then the rest is all small things, you know. You know, how ice behaves in below freezing environment is very different from how ice behaves in above freezing melty environment. How warm ice and cold ice interact is very different. And these little sciences that we know, we manipulate to the max to create what we create.
So where do you get the ice from? Like, is it a special kind of ice, or is it just, man, I just fill up, this is just regular old ice?
It is a special kind of ice. You know, in my industry standard, there's the carving blocks. It's a crystal clear ice. It's crystal clear because it's free of any air bubbles that's trapped inside that would naturally happen when you're freezing still water. You know, if you have a bucket of water in a freezer or below freezing environment, as is, you'll get very cloudy white ice, like ice you get in conventional freezer in your refrigerator, right? Those are tiny air bubbles that gets trapped inside because, you know, in the process, basically, when you're freezing from all sides, the last place that freezes is the middle of your water. And at that point, as water freezes, these air bubbles from air from H2O, you know, as it becomes more static, kind of release itself. And you know, there's no place for that to go. So you get these cloudy ice. Clear ice happens where we have two things. One direction freezing. So it's not freezing from all around, but for our machines. And our machine is not a special machine that we built, but it's an industry standard machine. But it freezes from bottom up, where there's only a coolant in the bottom, and all the rest of the sides just have insulations to kind of keep the temperature focused. So it freezes bottom up. And the second thing is moving water, agitating the water as it freezes. By freezing one direction, you're keeping the impurities and air bubbles on the surface of the ice as it freezes. And by moving the water, it kind of brushes the surface of the water constantly and releases the air bubbles as it goes. It's a slower process than freezing still water. So it takes about 3 days a cycle. An industry machine makes two blocks per machine, usually. Each block is about 300 pounds, about, you know, a little over 40 gallons of water. And I mean, that's how you make it. I mean, it's often said that it kind of mirrors how lake ice is made, because lake ice is kind of inverting that idea. Lake ice naturally is kind of moving, circulating within that lake. So the water is constantly moving, and it's freezing from top down. You know, the bottom is the warmest, relatively. So oftentimes, in old times, once you cut the whole snow part of the top ice, you get a very clear, bluish ice that you can pull out.
Will you ever use kind of like natural ice? Will you ever do that?
I mean, I've had an opportunity. There are, very choice ice sculpting competitions, exhibitions way up north. Famous ones are like the Ice Alaska up in Fairbanks, Alaska, to Yellowknife up in Yukon Territory in Canada. And where you can get natural ice, and it's where very hardcore ice carvers will love to come get together, and it's come a become a pilgrimage for top ice carvers to eventually get to, where you get to carve natural big blocks of ice to carve something. I've also had a chance, opportunity to carve glacial ice in the past, where I carving an iceberg. That was really interesting. That's a different ice, where ice resulted from, just thousands of years of compacted snow and rain and whatever into it. It's actually not a great carving ice. It's got a lot of sediments and volcano ashes and all these things that will really damage your tools right away. And it's very, porous and brittle and unexpected. But it's definitely a fun experience.
So then when you work on the ice, like what temperature are you like ideally? Like you're trying to work on the ice in this temperature of a room.
There are two ways of carving that we all come across. You're either a wet carver or dry carver. Dry carvers are those who carve in the freezer or below freezing environment. Wet carvers are those who carve outside the freezer. My father, who taught myself and many of the carvers that have grown to, become principal carvers for us at our studio, we all were taught as wet carvers first. There's a lot more variables to plan and think about, because your ice is melting as you're carving. Now, clear ice is slow melting ice, much, much slower than kind of the conventional kind of cloudy white ice. Being clear of air bubbles means it's got least amount of surface areas, and the rate of melting, I mean, other than the temperature, is really the exposure to that surface, where air can really react to the temperature more. So crystal clear ice is very slow melting ice, and even in the hottest days, in the above 90 degrees, it's workable. And of course, we just have to plan that much more to it. You have to really plan your steps. You need to save your details to the very, very end. Where you want to think about where you want to exaggerate certain forms, so you can kind of really hit that spot right when you're done. A dry carving is a different a game. When you're doing something very, very meticulous, detailed. A dry carving in the freezer will definitely free us of worrying about losing those details. So at that point, you can really focus on the forms and really push the boundaries of the materials. But sometimes it's harder to see where you're gonna get, because when you carve inside the freezer, your ice tend to get a little bit, hazier. So in which case we have to kind of blowtorch the surface or heat gun the surface to get it all clear up. I think you learn a lot more as a wet carver. It's kind of a old school way, an old world way of carving something. And just like anything, the old ways, everything's just more manual. It's everything's a little more right at the tip of your fingers, and you gotta be on your toes to get everything done. So But we do both at our studio.
Is there a rivalry between the wet and dry carvers? Like, oh, look at this guy. It's a
yeah.
wet carver. He can't carve dry.
Well, I mean, if you can wet carve, I mean, everyone who dry carves, any wet carvers can go in a freezer and be like, wow, this is so great. It's not melting, so I can have so much more fun. But I've come across many dry carvers have only carved inside a freezer, just panic when you're carving outside because, they haven't had the foresight, that brain muscle to really know to plan your course of action, because your ice is melting. So I think there's definitely an advantage when you know how to wet carve.
Do you have to kind of anticipate how the ice is going to change? Like, okay, I'm going to make this feature, but I know I have to make it like this and then let it melt down and then it will look the way that I want it to.
Yeah. There's definitely certainly way to modify, manipulate, accommodate, adjust the design based on melting. But mainly it's really, again, like knowing ice as a material. Oftentimes what we do, we run an arts business, we carve something and it has to leave the studio. It needs to be wrapped. It needs to be transported, oftentimes disassembled in parts, and then delivered to a site and then reassembled and then go through the duration of the event and live through its peak, viewing in those hours. So, we have to think about all of that as we're carving it. So if you're carving something pointy, we'll often not take it to that point, but give a little bit of bluntness, blunt tip at the edge. And that gives strength so that when you hit it, when you wrap it or as we hold it, it doesn't just break off. But it has enough taper that as it starts melting, and even then, like it has suggestions of point already, but strength given by its volume and the way it melts, really kind of follows that form. Some carvers may keep it chunky and say, well, this is going to look great, a couple hours into it. But I realize that it's, if the silhouette, if the lines are correct and tight, it melts that way. If you carve chunky, it stays chunky even as it melts away and disappears. And I always believe that with ice sculpture, it's the first impression. And as it melts away, that memory still kind of stays, So to me, experiencing ice sculpture is really more about the memory of what it is than what really is.
That kind of leads us into some of our listener-submitted questions. So are you ready for some harder/listener-submitted questions?
Yeah, let's do it.
So this first one is kind of along those lines in the sense that, do you look at the fact that it melts as sad or what makes it special?
I certainly am in a camp of it being very special that it melts away. On a personal level, it's that practice of letting go for me that I really appreciate. It's I get to really focus on the process. The beauty of working with ice is not the fighting of it disappearing. It's really the embracing of it disappearing. That's what makes it special. It's really amazing when people see our work and be so amazed at how much work we put into something that's disappearing. And that gap really activates the sculpture and that, I think, the art experience like nothing else a sculpture do,
Follow up that insightful and thoughtful answer with, how do you get rid of it? Like, do they just let it melt? Do they just throw it in the bathtub? Like, what do you do?
Yeah, there's a lot of logistics there. There's definitely an art of its own in disposing ice. But essentially, it's about breaking it and controlled, contained breaking. And again, that similar question of, is it sad to break it, can come into play. But I think all of us who work with ice also find it incredibly liberating to break it away too. If anything, it's like this stress reliever, you know? We often joke how, you know, we see these like, you know, break rooms where people can go into like abandoned cars and smash things to relieve your stress. It's very close to that. I mean, you know, it's great to go in there and just break everything. I mean, that's if our job is to just break what we got, it can be really fun. We can use various tools to break our ice, but our favorite tool of choice is a simple good old ice pick.
Is there anything that you can't do in the sense that like, oh, I would really like to do this. I would really like to do this sculpture, but you just can't do that with ice.
There's a lot you can do with ice. I mean, the only thing is we can't defy gravity. I mean, that's what I say to my clients, you know. We get to work with, you know, car designers and you know, design a runway and lighting designers, and we've made chandeliers, you know, out of ice and hanging from the trusses. And there's so much that we've been challenged to do, and it's really about solving problems.
What was your personal favorite piece? Thing that you've done that's like, oh, that was my favorite.
My favorite pieces are all public installations, you know, just because it's where we get to show slice of magic of what we do, and having the people who didn't expect to encounter our work to find in their, you know, passing our days to see our work and then interact with it and interact physically, you know, where our pieces are, where we invite people to touch our ice. That's another thing that I always love is I love people touching our work, you know, in kind of a, you know, art world etiquette, you don't touch art pieces, you know, you don't touch sculptures, but when people touch our sculptures and then be like, oh, wow, it's ice, it's really ice. And it's really this big, and why is it here, you know? And again, I love making ice sculptures in this city that I work in because we've got to do some really cool things, and we get to have a lot of people, you know, experience our work. I've done pieces where we've frozen 1,000 pairs of flip-flops in the middle of Union Square, where people are invited to, you know, try to melt the ice away and to grab, you know, pairs of flip-flops. Or, you know, we've done, you know, cityscape inspired pillars of ice where people can walk around like a maze. Just really cool things. And to be able to, again, share with people who are unexpecting.
Do you think that can this love raise to the level of kind of high art? And when I think of kind of high art in terms of like, you know, Guernica or Mona Lisa, do you think that this medium can raise to that level of high art?
I think so. Art is documented and understood in such spectrum today. And it's I think it's ultimately where we choose to engage ourselves in.
So this one here.
Yeah.
This is essentially a shoe. Like, how did you do this?
I mean, this is a great example of really having that little sneak peek of the whole magic of how you create something, you know? This is a video piece, a collaboration we did with Hypebeast, where I got to carve, the Air Jordan. I mean, you can see in the video, it starts from a block of ice. And we, you know, I cut it to the overall volume of the block. And I did a simple grid transfer of the image. And then I used a chainsaw. No matter how big, how small the sculpture is, I would say about 70% of the work we do, we use a chainsaw. It's an electric chainsaw that we use. And I cut the negative space, and then I do the basic leveling, the kind of the volume, the angles. I push the chainsaw as much as I can. It's amazing. You can see how amazing level of finesse you can get from something as brute as chainsaw. There's a lot that you can do. And then once we have the shape pretty much set, I use what we call a chipper, which is basically like a multi-prong ice pick, which has been kind of a preferred tool, very similar to chisels, but much easier to maintain and eats ice much easier. So I use a chipper or a chisel to get the final overall volume. And then I use die grinders to really fine-tune that shape. And die grinders have different bits, the heads that can create the shape. Like in this video, I have a burr, which is this tiny prickled bit. It's an orange head bit that you see in the video that really shaves off all the corners and edges of the shape that I've chipped away. And that really kind of smooths out the overall shape. And I really kind of finish the total complete outer volume of the shape. And then from there, I use finer bits like knife bits and needle bits, as we call them. As you can see from the name, they had a finer tip. Sometimes I'll finish off with small chisels to, push down certain areas so it look like it's overlapping, one's on top of the other or going under. That's about it. And then I finish it off with either a torch or sometimes even a splash of water, and get it all nice and clear.
I noticed that, but why is the blow, now why does the blowtorch make it look like that? Like I'm looking at it and it's a little bit, I'll just use the word like kind of cloudy, and then you hit it with that blowtorch and I'm like, oh my God.
Well, the final tools that we use are so fine that in between the tool bit marks, snow gets inside, So the haziness comes from the snow, and in this instance, it was a nice cold day, so there's some frost that can remain or maintain on the ice surface. So we often do a finish with either water or blowtorch to get the true clarity, to really kind of basically melt down the snow particles that sticks to the ice. And once that's cleared up, once we put it in the freezer, all those wet surfaces will dry up right away, and it becomes a stable, final state, stage of the sculpture.
Now, how long did that take you to do?
I mean, the sculpture itself probably took about an hour itself to really carve it. I would like to go fast as I can because I'm carving outside the freezer one, so I'm wet carving here. So ice is slowly melting, but I can go that fast because I took my time to plan my tools. I can go that fast because I did my drawing. So I think it's a very fair thing to always calculate how much plan goes in there too,
Yeah, there's a huge difference between the time that like I'm actually physically working on it versus the preparation for it. Let me find, like it's really impressive. I have no artistic ability
No.
whatsoever. Like just is this a whole car?
That was a fun collaboration I did with Porsche. And this was cool because I got to carve the replica of the sculpture. And then we blowtorched it down to nothing. But then the director then played it backwards, so, as if the fire is what's making the sculpture. So that was his narrative, and gave me this concept, and I just thought it was so brilliant, simple and direct and really kind of turning itself.
I'm amazed at the amount of intricacy that you can get in there. Now, how? So, okay, I don't know anything about art, so this question is might not make any sense. But like, how do you get kind of the perspective on it in the sense where, like, you can see the angles, it looks three-dimensional? Like, do you have to account for the way that light is going to hit it?
You know, creating a sculpture, I mean, to do anything, right? Anything you do, you break it down to small pieces. And it's about putting together the building blocks to get to your goal, right? So for sculptures, it's a 3D piece. We can break it down to a series of 2D pieces, you know? So you understand the front, the sides.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? The backs and tops. You take those measurements, and then you piece them together, and you naturally get the 3D piece. Achieve that. That said, in our studio, I think almost all of my carvers that I work with, they're painters. And maybe because, one, my background is in painting. I'm a painter. I think everything in paintings. But I think, too, as a painter, as a draftsman, I quickly learned that you carve as well as you draw. You know, you need to know how to draw. And especially because what we do, we don't make sculptures that investigates the material of ice. You know, what we do is not just abstract pieces. You know, it's not what we want to do only. We create pieces what our clients bring to our table every day. And one day we'll carve a replica of you, Nick, you know, we carve a replica of a Porsche. Air Jordan sneakers, or a logo, or a building, or whatnot, or a kangaroo, and we need to have this basic knowledge of proportions of things in the world. We often talk about that, you kind of have to know these things. You have to have a very deep, I think, sixth sense of what things kind of is shaped like, we all have this general curiosities of shape in everything. And that's a very, very special thing that I always look for with people that I work with. You just have to be curious about everything.
So what is this? Tell me about this.
This was a collaboration we've done with Hunter Boots. People love seeing things frozen inside ice. You know, when you see something frozen inside ice, again, there's another sense of timelessness. You know, there's a, frozen in time that's literally there,
That's pretty much all the questions I've got. Is there anything that you think that we missed or anything like that?
Ice sculpting, ice carving, I think is fascinating because it kind of exists outside of, I think, what people understand as an art world. You know, it's essentially an outsider art genre. You know, it's a sculpture that's often mostly done by non-art trained artists. You know, because ice carving most often come across, especially in America, through culinary lineage. It's many of the ice carvers are people who were ex-chefs, and it's a very passionate community. It's a very innovative community because almost all of our tools are something that's developed from taking tools off the shelf from hardware stores and then modifying it to work with ice. And then sharing that with ice community at large. So I fell in love with this craft, I think, a lot less about the craft itself, but really people. And even for today, I have so many mentors in the ice community who are constantly pushing the material. And I really owe to them more than anything with what we get to do every day. And I don't take it for granted all the knowledge and skill set that we have, that it's really in the pillars and foundations of so many crazy ass people who work with ice.
I want to thank Shintaro so much for joining us. If you want to connect with him, we have linked to him on our social media sites. We're Profoundly Pointless on TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube. And we've also included his information in the episode description. If you want to see more of some of the sculptures and how he creates them, the YouTube version of this episode will be live on November 30th at 12:30 p.m. Pacific. One show change that I probably should have mentioned a long time ago, but just kind of forgot about, is that we're restructuring the way that we do the show. We're still going to have exactly the same kind of guests and exactly the same kind of conversations. It's just that we're going to group things along monthly themes. So October, we did spooky. November was sex and money. December is going to be all winter. And then going into January, we're going to look at the future. Okay, now let's bring in John Shull and get to the pointless part of the show. Do you have any artistic talent?
No.
What areas of life do you feel like you just have no talent in?
Probably anything to do with art.
I feel like I have no talent artistically. I can't repair or fix anything or build anything.
I mean, am I good at cooking? Probably not. But I like to do it. So, I mean, do I have talent? No.
I can't cook. But I don't have a sense of smell, so I have a really good reason for me not to be able to cook because I don't care about it. Like, nobody would ever look at me and be like, who should cook this? We'll have him do it. Like, no, I shouldn't be the one doing that.
What are you afraid to cook?
I have never cooked for anyone else.
Except your wife.
No, not even my wife. I have never, like, cooked for my wife. I've browned meat or something like that, but I don't have a sense of smell. So, like, why would I cook for somebody? Why would I be like, well, who should do it? Right? Like, we need somebody to look something up. Well, you wouldn't have the blind guy do it. Right? Like, well, that's not the ideal choice.
I feel like that's going to a completely, like, you know, far left or right example there, but
it's but an I guess accurate it makes example, sense. Right? It's also losing a sense that is crucial to that thing.
I honestly feel, though, that if the roles were reversed and I had just admitted to you that I had never cooked a meal for Melissa, you would be dragging me through the mud if I had a smell or not.
No, because I like to me, though, that didn't make it like I don't see why that's a big deal.
I mean, I think it's more the thought. It's more of taking the time and effort to try and, you know, do something for the other person, whether it's good or not. I'm more amazed at the fact that you've never cooked a meal for her. How did you get away with that?
Why? Because I don't have a sense of smell. Why would it? Like, do you want me to make something for you that's not going to taste good? No.
I mean, I'd still...
Okay, then. Like, that's a pretty easy situation to solve.
I'd still take it. You know, if you came to me and you're like...
To me, that's just a waste of time. I don't understand that at all. But I want you to do something poorly for me.
But here's the thing. Maybe you're actually an outstanding cook, but you've never tried it.
I'm not. I've made meals for my children. They're not any good.
That doesn't count.
Why doesn't it count? It's the same basic principle. I don't understand why you would want someone to do something for you if you know that they're not good at it.
I understand what you're saying. I don't think you've given it a fair chance. That's all I'm saying.
You want grilled cheese? I'll make grilled cheese. I've made my wife grilled cheese. I'm not going to sit there and try to make her like pasta vizzoule.
All right. Let's see. We'll start with Robert Miles. Winston Wolf. A little alliteration there. That's cool. Jim Knotts, Matt Taylor, Christian Wageley, David Perez, Brian Puninsky, Michael Vivier, Renee Avila, and Brian Reyes. Appreciate all of you.
Okay.
God, but that was crisp. That was crisp and clean. got some bangers for you.
Okay.
This one's a weird one, and I'm not really sure. Most of these came to me while I was sitting thinking after a couple of pops over the weekend. So I don't know how these are going to turn out, but...
are they legible? Like, did you write them down?
I wrote them down on my phone, but the words were so misjumbled. But I think I got it.
Why didn't you just use voice to text?
I mean, you've been inebriated. Do you think things through? Because I don't.
No, not really, but I still use voice to text. If you use voice to text, do you hold the phone out in front of you or to the side of you?
Oof. Probably out in front. I don't utilize that very often.
Oh, I've become too lazy to even like type out text messages. I want voice to text the whole way.
You want the BlackBerry back is what you want.
I loved my BlackBerry. It was a great phone. Still the best phone I ever had. So easy.
All right. Let's see. So this one, I believe this is what it was. Would you rather be a kid your entire life or an adult your entire life?
How old is a kid? I need to know specifics, right? There's a big difference between being a five-year-old. I don't want to be a five-year-old all my life. I could be maybe an 18-year-old all my life.
No, that'd I'm going to say 12 or 43.
God dang, that's like a hard age range too. Well, 43, man. I mean, ultimately, you want to be able to like experience life and do all kinds of stuff. You don't want to go through life as a 12-year-old. That's not because you won't be able to do a whole bunch of stuff. Right? You couldn't explain to people that, no, I'm actually 47. I just look like a 12-year-old. So I'd rather be 43, especially if you were going to be like immortal. Well, not immortal, yeah. But your whole life at 43? That's a pretty good deal. That's this is an easy answer. Okay. I think I would much rather anything under 70. I would rather spend my whole life under that. I'd rather spend my life as an adult. You can do all the adult things.
I don't. I think there's a sense of honesty of being 12 your entire life. You could just have fun, no real responsibility. Could eat and drink all the crap you wanted.
Be good. Yeah, but you're gonna be like looking like a 12-year-old when you've been alive for like 50 years, man. You're gonna be pretty tired of playing at the playground.
I mean, listen, Benjamin Button, calm down over there. You look like you're 12.
I'm just saying. Well, that's a compliment. I'll take that.
You know, that leads me to something else here. All right. Okay, I was age profiled over the weekend, and I'm a little upset about it. I'm at a grocery store checking out, and I had a bottle of tequila that I was buying, and the woman comes over. She wasn't going to check my ID. She looks at me and she goes, "You don't have any gray hair, so I'm going to need to see your ID."
Okay. Sounds like she's doing her job.
I look 40. I clearly do not look 21 and under. But because I don't have any gray hair, so my question is, I don't know if that's a compliment or if I look so young that like it's just not attractive anymore. I don't know.
Well, it's probably an insult if you're under 25, but if you're like 40 and somebody's checking your ID, that's a compliment.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, it's an insult if you're that age, but like, if you're like 22 and somebody's like, "You look like a 16-year-old," then you're like, "Oh,
cool." Like, I kind of got a half annoyed for like a quick second because I'm like, I have some gray hair. Well, I just took my – wow, gray.
That's a good way to do it. I don't mind it, actually.
So clearly, she wasn't looking at my hair. She just wanted to find an excuse to card me, which is fine. I don't mind. Like, I'm all for it. But, you know, don't come at me, is what I'm saying.
Why do you let these minor inconveniences affect your life?
Because I think...
Like, why do you let this affect your life? This would not affect me for any second, right? If somebody carded me and was like, "Hey, I need to see your ID for a second," 1 second after they hand it back to me, I've already forgotten about it. Like, you can't dwell on these things, man.
Okay, here.
You gotta move on with your life.
At what age do you start to get annoyed when you get carded?
Never, because it's just somebody doing their job.
It's
like if I was 97 and somebody was like, "Hey, we need to see your ID." I'm like, "Okay, cool. Here it is." Like, what's the big deal?
Do you know why you never get
a second of your life?
Do you know why you never get carded? Is because you buy the shittiest beer and they know someone who's super old is buying that beer.
Maybe because I don't really stress out about little situations, so that keeps me looking younger, and then I get carded over things.
I didn't say that I was stressed out. I was just like, like, you were already punching in, the okay, and then you look at me, and then now you want my ID.
They probably remember that they have to scan it for, like, store policy, and they just thought of something to say to you so that they didn't have to hear you get all pissed off about it.
Also,
so they're like, I could just say that this is store policy, I didn't need to card you. Or they could be like, "Oh, you look young," And then you'll be like, oh, I guess I do. And then hand it to them, right? They're just suckering you in, man. They're just
suckering. Why did you just make me sound like Santa Claus for a second?
Because Well, you probably like, I do look young today, right? Like, you're a gabber. You know, you're a gabber.
I did, actually. I did turn around, and I was like, I'll be carded anytime. That's a great thing. And, God.
Yeah, see, right? They suckered you right in. You played right into their hand. Now they got your ID, all your information. They probably opened a bank account in your name. And pretty soon, you're going to be living on the street all because of this one interaction.
But I did get the tequila, and it made for a fantastic evening.
I can't drink tequila, man, anymore. Even the word is like.
I had to get something, and it was a wrestling pay per view night.
Oh boy!
So you know it was a good night Saturday last. See, last
that
Saturday.
Means whacking off in the basement. Was, like,
I don't know where you're going with that one. Just like I have no idea where I was going with this one.
Why are you gonna get upset about getting carded and then go home and buy a wrestling pay per view? Like, I'm an adult. Time to get this wrestling pay-per-view.
Hey, just so you know, wrestling is a global thing. It's just not, you know, a lot of us out there, so be careful.
Hey, man, your thing.
We've had a professional wrestler on the podcast.
Isn't he good now? I thought he was doing really well.
He was. He's still around.
he was. Okay.
Anyways, would you rather wrestle an alligator... or a gorilla? Probably a gator, right?
Yeah. Okay. Because they don't have hands, right? Like, I could probably do better against an alligator because I could just get on top of it. Like, if I just held on, what's it going to do? A gorilla has arms and hands. It's going to tear you apart.
But see, I feel like if the gator gets you, you have a less chance of doing anything than if a gorilla is in the same position. Like, I feel like a gator's going to wrap you up and drown you, as where at least, a gorilla's probably going to smash your face in. But at least for a half second, you may have a better chance of trying to escape.
But I think that the gator has less of a chance of getting you. Maybe you have a point in that regard. I think it's completely over if either one of them gets a hold of you. But I think you have a better chance of, like, evading the gator for longer. The gorilla's just going to absolutely wreck you.
Oh, man, it's... Yeah, like I said, I don't know where any of these have come from, but good ideas come in the middle of just thinking about
things. Oh, yeah. It's amazing if you just stop and let your brain run for a couple of seconds, like how many thoughts are just ping-ponging around up
there. Oh, man.
You don't know what's going to happen.
Which we never do, right? Like, we never do.
I do every Friday and Saturday night. Take a bunch of edibles and just stare into the night and think about thoughts.
Engage into those activities. Yeah. All right, last one here. It's more of a question than a banger. But what kind of Christmas tree do you have? You go cut one down. Do you have a fake one?
I have a fake one, right? Fake trees and titties are my favorite things in life. Why get the real one when the fake ones can be superior, right? That's so much easier. I don't have to go pick it out. I don't have to worry about, is this going to be a good one? I don't have to worry about how much it's going to cost, getting rid of it. Just go get the fake tree and be done with it. And if you want the scent, then buy a candle. I'm sure you've got many recommendations of candles that smell like trees.
I mean, we can start if you want. There's even a pine tree one.
Can you just give us a one and not go down the road of 50 grams of candle recommendations? Just give us a good tree-scented candle.
Good tree-scented candle. Well, first one that comes to my mind, it's I have to look up the name. Pine Star? I think it's called Pine Star by Yankee Candle. It's just amazing. I don't know. It just smells like pure pine. However... if you have a fake tree, I'm going to recommend – they actually sell, like, things that you can put in the tree that will give it an aroma of being and smelling like an actual tree.
Okay. But do you go buy a real tree every year? Carry that damn thing home.
I used to, and then the pandemic happened, and we bought a fake tree. And that's one of the good things that actually came out of the pandemic for me, is I learned how much of an idiot I was for ever wanting a real tree.
Yeah, I mean, a fake tree is way easier. I could care less about a real tree. Like, is it real? Is it fake? It's a tree either way. Don't yeah, care at I mean, all.
I mean, you know, I get it. Like, it's all part of the shtick. But, you know, there's no needles that drop. It's easy to take up. It's easy to put down. It's, yeah, it's just easier.
I think it's cheaper, too. I'd much rather have a fake tree.
Because you're going to make fun of me for this. But when we did do it, we used to go to a tree farm and cut down the tree. So there was, if anything, there was multiple other men like my, and women like myself and others who would physically cut trees down. And by the time you're done cutting a tree down, I didn't give a shit how big it was. So let's just get it in the wagon to get it back to the car.
I can't actually imagine you cutting down a tree. Did you use an axe or a saw?
A saw. It's actually a handsaw at that. It's actually, it's not bad. You always have that one, you know, overzealous person who brings a chainsaw.
You don't really need a chainsaw to cut down through a 1-inch tree. No. But anyway, you should have used an axe. The only appropriate way to cut down a tree is with an axe, because that's how a man does it. I don't care what else you're doing; it should be done with an axe. And quite frankly, the forearms need to be shown. Okay. That would be my rule. If I was ever like running a lumberjack place or a tree place, everybody cuts down the tree with an axe, and you've got to roll up your sleeves, because if you don't, you're not doing it correctly.
All of your lumberjacks would have their forearms showing while sweating.
You got to have your forearms showing. If you don't have forearms showing and you're using it, not using an axe, you're not cutting down a tree. It's not the right way to do it.
Don't know what kind of business you're going to be running there, but sounds like you're going to have a lot of applicants. So good luck.
Clearly,
luck
you've there. Never seen the Brawny Man.
Yes, I think so. Yeah, I have. Terrible reference, but yes, I have.
Who do you think would win in a fight between who do you think would win in a fight between the Brawny guy and Mr. Clean? Like, which one of those guys do you think can handle his business better?
Well, I mean, I remember Mr. Clean smiling a lot. So on basis of that alone, he seems way too happy. So I'm going to go with Mr. Brawn.
You don't think that he has, like, he's not aggressive enough? You think Mr. Clean is too much of a nice guy?
Yeah, he reminds me of a former coworker of ours.
Oh, yeah, he does, actually, now that I think about it. I think Mr. Clean would actually win. I think the Brawny guy puts on a good show, but I think Mr. Clean is the guy who can get down to business when he needs to.
I mean, was there ever a celebrity death match that pitted them against each other? There has to be someone that did this.
There has to be. I still think Mr. Clean would win. I think he can take out the Brawny guy. Okay. Do you have any other bangers? Any other thoughts?
No, that's it. We learned enough about you from this episode.
Okay. So our top five is top five winter animals. What's your number five?
So my number five, I don't even want to put them on the list because I detest these animals. But they have to be, if you're talking about winter-esque animals, they have to be on the list, and that's penguins.
Oh, penguins should be much higher on there.
Penguins
are a fantastic winter animal.
I agree, but I don't like them for whatever reason, and they're lucky to get on my top five.
Why do you have such a problem with penguins?
I just think they're overrated animals. They're like dolphins to me. Like, they're just overrated animals that have been propelled to the top of the animal food chain by us humans, and I just don't get it.
They're cute, and they walk funny. I agree with you about dolphins, though. I don't trust those. I don't trust dolphins.
I mean, super obese people waddle, and we don't put them in a zoo and laugh at them.
Well, do they have suits on? Do they look like they have a tuxedo on? Then maybe we would.
Do they eat raw fish and make weird noises?
My number five is the walrus. I don't think that walruses get enough credit as an animal. They're kind of sweet.
They're huge, man. They are gigantic. I think that's what people don't get. They're like 1,000-pound animals. Like, they are large creatures.
The problem is that I think that people get seals, sea lions, and walruses all kind of mixed up slightly, and you think that the walrus isn't that much bigger, and then you see a walrus, and you're like, holy crap.
That's funny you mentioned that. That's my number four, is a seal.
Oh, I don't know. How's that a winter animal?
My only basis for putting them as a winter animal is because they're, you know, every time you see a documentary about, you know, the North Pole or the South Pole or somewhere where it's cold, and they always show orcas feeding, and the cold waters are always going after seals. So
I would never consider a seal to be a winter animal, man.
They very well
consider it to be the exact opposite, to be honest.
Could not be. But that's my perception of them.
My number four is a reindeer.
See, I left off reindeer. Once again, I feel like they're friggin' overrated, man. Overrated animals.
If you had a bunch of, like, deer-like animals lined up, like an elk, a moose, a deer, and a reindeer, could you actually pick them out and be like, nope, that's a reindeer, not an elk?
The moose, I think I could, only because... By the way, I feel like I'm going to get hammered on social media for the seal number four. And I've been pretty impressed with the amount of people commenting. So bring it, I guess. But regardless, I'm saying that to say this. I believe moose are way bigger than both of those species. That's how I think you'd be able to know the difference.
I couldn't tell the difference between a reindeer and a caribou. I don't know if they're actually even a different thing. I don't know if I could tell the difference between a rainbow, a caribou, and an elk, but I could tell the difference between a deer. And a moose is gigantic. I've seen a moose in, like, real life, and it's like, whoa. Just, you better get the hell away from that thing.
That thing's pissed.
They're mean animals. They're very mean animals. They'll follow you, man. Don't mess with a moose. People are worried about bears, but you should really be worried about moose.
All right, well, my number three... I don't even know how to transition from that properly. I have an orca as my number three.
I don't know really what your classification of winter animals is, to be honest with you. I think that you just thought of places, animals that live in cold places, and were like, I guess that counts.
Just go with it, man, because I'm going to get butchered on this, but okay, I don't know. For all I mean, I know that, you know, orcas... They're like a Pacific Northwest animal, and they go into the Atlantic Ocean down near Antarctica. They're in cold water, which all water is cold.
You know, Antarctica is south, right?
Like, yeah. What did I say? North? I meant that they go south. Sorry.
Yeah, that's towards Antarctica, but yeah. The Arctic. I still get confused. Let's just okay. Well. My number three is a real winter animal, a snow owl. Not only do I think a snow animal is a sweet winter animal, but I think it's probably my favorite owl. Easily.
Once again, owls are overrated.
I don't have a problem with owls. I mean, what do you think is more sick of hearing people make noises at it? An owl or a wolf?
Oof, that's actually a great question. I feel like owls don't give a shit. I don't know why, but when you look at an owl, they just look like they don't give a shit what you're thinking.
Yeah, they seem like they're probably smarter and that they don't really care too much. They're like, oh, these idiots. But a wolf seems like they probably get a little bit annoyed. I've been to places where they're like a zoo with a wolf, and they specifically put, like, don't howl at the wolves.
All right, my number two is a moose.
Okay. Moose is respectable. I don't know. Again, I'm not sure what qualifies as a winter animal, but that's fine. Whatever. I think you just picked animals. Like, what is it? Big and lives north.
Yeah.
Pick it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, why not?
I mean, oh, it's really none of this really makes any sense if you think about it. It's not like all these animals aren't alive during the summer. I mean, it's just kind of like we just decided, like, that's a winter animal. My number two is a penguin, specifically an emperor penguin. Nah. I think of that as a winter animal.
Yeah, I mean, like, overrated. I don't know how, I mean, the only good penguin was Danny DeVito.
He was a good penguin, right? Like, he was born to play that. It's like, who's going to be the penguin? Like, well, Danny DeVito. And everybody, as soon as that role was announced, he just was like, well, I'm going to be that.
Guess I'm winning my Oscar perfect. Now.
Did he win an Oscar for it?
No, God, no, man, terrible.
Oh, because he didn't deserve it. I don't think enough credit goes to actors who played like roles that we like. I think we have the same number one. Though,
you have to. There really is only one dominant winter animal, and that is the polar bear.
Polar bear. I 100% agree that the polar bear is the dominant winter animal, because not only do I think of it and associate it with winter, but I also think of it as like the North Pole. Those Coca-Cola commercials. It's the dominant winter animal.
And, you know, it's gigantic. It has snow that, or fur that reflects what it lives in, the snow. I mean, come on, man.
What color is a polar bear's fur?
This is a trick question. My first initial reaction is to say white or gray, but I'm guessing it's going to be like brown or something.
A polar bear's skin is actually black, and the polar bear's fur is also translucent.
Hmm. Wow.
So it has clear fur. Oh, it does look black. That's kind of crazy.
Everyone listening to this is now Googling what a polar bear looks like.
The hair of a polar bear appears white because air spaces in each hair scatter light of all colors. And it is mostly around the color white, so that's why it appears to be white. But the hair is actually translucent, which is crazy to think about. Okay, what's your honorable mention? Do you have any honorable mention? Any other animals?
So I have an Arctic hare bunny.
Okay.
An Arctic fox.
Okay. And the other animals with the word Arctic in front of it. She just decided.
I was actually just trying to think of one, but I
can't think of another one either.
Yeah, I don't think I can think of another one.
Arctic owl?
An Arctic owl, yes, but not the kind of owl that you decided to put on the list. Yeah, I mean, not many others. Not really.
Okay, we have an Arctic hare, an Arctic fox. That's it. an Arctic tern, an Arctic woolly bear, an Arctic wolf. Oh. Okay, that's probably enough. The Arctic grouse. You know what animal I would put in there that I'm just now looking at is the musk ox. Like that big-ass ox with a bunch of hair. That looks pretty sweet.
Yeah, or a buffalo.
It's not a buffalo. It's a musk ox. It's a very different thing. I'm not getting into this whole debate with you about the buffalo. For people who aren't familiar with it, John thinks that he can outrun a buffalo, which a buffalo can run at 40 miles an hour. It doesn't make any sense to anyone why he thinks that he can outrun something. I guess.
He's going to cut me off before I finish this. But it was a bet or a wannabe bet that I could I think I said I could finish a 40 with a 10-yard head start standing still before a buffalo.
No, you couldn't. And then part about the head start was something that you just now added in there because you're trying to cover up for it and making you're slightly realizing that there's absolutely no chance. I don't think that you could run 40 yards, to be honest with you.
You're crazy.
I don't think that you could. I don't think that you could sprint 40 yards right now without hurting yourself. You could go outside, dead sprint 40 yards right now and not pull a muscle.
Yep.
Or trip. Or fall down? Yeah. I don't agree with that at all. Dude, no.
I'm only in my mid-30s. If any mid-30 person, no matter your condition or shape, can't sprint for 8 seconds, then you got other issues.
I actually know very few people who are in their mid-30s who do not regularly, who don't play professional sports that could run right now dead sprint and not hurt themselves.
I mean, obviously, I'd do a quick warm-up. Like, I would do a stretch so I don't tear a hamstring like I did one time.
Exactly. That was terrible. You know what? I don't even need to get it right. Yeah. I won't get hurt.
No, I won't get hurt.
I have been hurt doing the exact same thing in the past.
I won't get hurt.
Okay, that's going to go ahead and do it for this episode of Profoundly Pointless. I want to thank you so much for joining us. If you get a chance, leave us a quick review. We really appreciate it. It really does help us out. And let us know what you think are some of the best winter animal. There really doesn't seem to be any classification or qualifications for the winter animals that we chose. It's basically entirely subjective. But I do think that polar bear is the best winter animal. I don't know about some of John's choices. I wouldn't consider them to be winter animals, but whatever.